From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
For over a decade, California has led the nation in climate change legislation, and it's been a bipartisan effort, with support from Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and Democratic Governor Jerry Brown. What are the goals of the state's climate change laws, and what impact will they have on Californians generally, and California businesses in particular? We'll ask the author of the state's key climate change laws, State Senator Fran Pavley, and one of California's business leaders, Rob Lapsley, president of the California Business Roundtable. California's climate change legislation, too little too late or too much too soon?
We'll also hear from Nathan Alonzo, the government affairs manager with the Fresno Chamber of Commerce, Daniel Bergstrom, the director of government affairs for the city of Fresno, and former state Senate majority leader and current Cal Air Resources Board member Dean Flores.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Over the last decade, California has led the nation in enacting laws dealing with climate change. Our guest is the author behind that legislation, Senator Fran Pavley from Los Angeles. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So you've been called the pioneer of climate change movement. You've authored laws on reducing vehicle emissions in 2002, landmark 2006 legislation, AB 32 that required the reduction of greenhouse gases to 1990 levels by 2020. And then most recently, 2016 legislation, SB 32, that cut emissions to 40% below 1990 levels by 2030. That's a lot of legislation. Why did you pick this particular area of public policy to focus on?
Well, I think it was because of my background. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley during those horrible smoggy days where I remember as a child not being able to go recess. And the main contributor was cars. Cars cause smog. Smog is unhealthy. Then, fast forward, I went to Fresno State. also has problems with air pollution and it affects children's health. So that's been my passion and interest in tying vehicle emissions. And there's a direct link between criteria air pollutants and climate change.
Yeah, my brother lived in Los Angeles during the late 70s, early 80s, and I remember him telling me you couldn't see downtown. It was so polluted, but things have improved pretty dramatically since then. So AB 32, considered groundbreaking legislation in 2006, was the state's first major piece of climate change legislation. Former Governor Schwarzenegger, I can't say it in his voice, but he called it the most powerful environmental law, period. What were the major provisions of AB 32?
Well, I think the three that resonate with the public the most was the tailpipe emission bill that you referenced, and that's making all cars more fuel efficient, giving customers a broader choice of vehicles. That's why you see in the road now traditional vehicles, but also those hybrids or electric cars or hydrogen fuel cell. And so that's part of it. Also part of it is really investing in energy efficiency. That's sort of the low-hanging fruit. That's where you can get the most greenhouse gas emissions reductions for the least cost. So energy efficiency appliances. It was very controversial to put an appliance standard on refrigerators. Mm-hmm. Who knew?
And now...
And they said it would be too expensive. Other states wouldn't want California's model. Now other states all want California's model on energy efficient refrigerators. And it's saving homeowners money on their energy bill.
Right. Instead of mandating regulations, so AB 32 had something kind of interesting. They established something called cap and trade. Can you briefly describe California's cap and trade program?
Do we have a few hours?
No.
A cap means what it does. We, first of all, put a cap on emissions and we're rolling them back to 1990 levels of reduction. That's the market signal we want to send. Now, we could have done that through a straight regulatory approach.
All
major polluters, right, mm-hmm. would have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Or we can say, yes, if you're a major polluter and you can't reduce those emissions, it's not cost effective. There's a different approach. You can then purchase what's called allowances so that the government can invest in greenhouse gas emission reductions maybe somewhere else. Could be by providing rebates to middle class vehicle drivers in their new cars or energy efficiency in someone's homes. So it was a way to either be mandated strictly through command and control, regulated to reduce your emissions, or if you cannot, for whatever reason, it's not cost effective, it's not technologically feasible, you can sort of what I call pay to pollute. Contribute money into this account that will be expended thoughtfully around the state of California for the express purpose of reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
The idea behind CapTrain is kind of interesting, is you let companies and individuals be creative as to how they're going to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions as opposed to telling them this is what you have to do. So all that creativity comes out and you find more effective ways to deal with the problem.
And the businesses wanted this. This concept of cap and trade came from the business community, not just California businesses, but national businesses.
Well, let me ask you, it's been 10 years since AB 32 became law. Has it accomplished what you had hoped it would accomplish?
In almost every category, absolutely. What we look at overall, have we reduced greenhouse gas emissions? Can we quantify that? Yes, we can. They've reduced considerably. We will meet our 2020 targets. And has it been done in a cost-effective manner? Has our economy improved while we've been reducing emissions? Yes, it's substantially improved over the last 20 years, despite the recession.
So it hasn't hurt the economy like some people feared?
It not only hasn't hurt the economy, it sent that market signal to new businesses to invest in places, even like Fresno. We are seeing a variety of solar companies come into Fresno, but areas all over the state where they're being profitable, and they say it's because of our policies, not in spite of our policies, but because of them.
Well, let me ask you this. PPIC had a survey that shows that the partisan divide on climate change has gotten even greater since 2006, since AB 32 was passed. Why is that?
I would lay some of the blame on Washington, D.C. I'm not sure why everything has to be so partisan back there. I'll tell you, in 2002, I was getting support letters on my tailpipe emission bill from John McCain and Republicans. We had Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signing AB 32. We've always had a few brave Republican legislators vote for these bills, renewable energy standards, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's because of powerful special interest money. It's hard. Sometimes transition is hard. And as we change from an economy based on fossil fuels like coal and oil to a new cleaner energy future, some people don't want that transition and they don't want that change and they're using their lobbying power to affect
policymakers.
And
it just could be that the partisan nature of politics on many topics is just, this is one of the topics that it's become very highly partisan. But anyway, I appreciate the background on the state's climate change legislation. Well, up next, what about the new legislative attempts to expand California's climate change legislation? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report. Welcome back. We're talking with Senator Fran Pavley, the author of AB 32 and now the author of SB 32, the state's new climate change law that comes on the heels of previous climate change legislation and efforts. You know, what is in, so we got this new law, SB 32, passed by the legislature, signed by Governor Brown. What are the major provisions of SB 32? How does it expand AB 32?
What it does, it builds on AB 32, those existing policies like energy efficiency and cleaner cars, but we'll have to build on them to achieve even greater reduction targets as envisioned. So one thing we're doing is really ramping up renewable energy. By 2030, we want everyone's energy mix to be 50% renewable. Wind, solar, geothermal. We're thinking in-state production of energy is smart for several reasons. It's good for the environment. It also creates in-state jobs. We don't have to be dependent on out-of-state. We're not going to be gamed, for example, by Enron again and what happened to the energy deregulation. So that's going to be an incredibly important piece of that. But we're going to need some new technologies and new ideas to meet these reduction targets. But by passing SB 32, it's now in statute. We're sending those market signals to investors, and we think the innovators, clean technology experts, are going to be very engaged. I've spoken to biofuel companies in three locations in the state. They are now hiring new people. They're expanding. They know there will be a market.
You know, business wants predictability. They want to know if it's going to be there, so they're going to, if they invest, there's a reason for them to invest, so it probably gave them the right signal. Let me ask you this, though. You know, the state's often accused of
spending money so fast, it's unbelievable. But the opposite actually has been true with cap and trade funds. For several years, money was being collected, about $1 billion, and not being spent until recently. Recently, that logjam was broken, and the funds are now starting to be spent. Why was there a logjam, and where's the money now being spent?
The money is being spent in a variety of categories, some of it in the transit area, inner city transit and things, some in weatherization, a lot of it for having to do with vehicle rebates and things like that for all income levels. A large amount of money is also being expended in ways that benefit particularly disadvantaged communities.
Places like the San Joaquin Valley.
Exactly like the San Joaquin Valley. There's places all over California, but the San Joaquin Valley should benefit proportionally very well in the investment of greenhouse gas emissions. And there's some great legislators from this area who will be championing that.
You know, recently, though, the state and cap auction has brought in less money than they anticipated. Is there a problem here with cap and trade? If there is, can it be saved?
Well, I think part of the problems was twofold. One, there was a point in time that the investors in cap and trade and everyone involved with cap and trade didn't know if these policies would go on past 2020.
Right.
If the policies weren't going to continue.
Because AB 32 said 2020.
Expired 2020.
Right.
So now with SB 32 being signed into law, they
now
it's have a particular. It's 2030. It's 14 years away. I would suggest that there may be then now more willingness for people to purchase these allowances. A lot of them have banked them over the last few years. I think they wanted to wait and see. If they don't need any more past 2020, then why purchase any more? So I think this will be helpful into having a more favorable outcome, perhaps in November, December, the next time we have an auction.
Okay, so the signal's now been set. Let me kind of switch gears a little bit. California's little Hoover Commission did a report a while ago that suggested while a lot has been done to limit greenhouse gases, much less has been done to adapt to the impacts of climate change. Do you agree? Do you think the state should be doing more to deal with the impacts of climate change?
We have to do all of the above, frankly. And a lot of the things we can do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions also is a way to adapt to a changing climate. For example, let's take drought. That's one of the characteristics of climate change. Less snowpack or less rainfall, we're going to have less water. Doesn't water conservation measures, that's a way to adapt, but it's also a way to reduce water and energy needs. 20% of all of our energy use is moving, treating, and heating water. Can we do things to make that not as energy intensive? Investing in energy efficiency. So there's a wide variety of strategies. Should we be making plans right now, whether it's in the Delta or infrastructure improvements, for example, airports that are in low-lying areas along our coast, like San Francisco Bay? Absolutely. Thoughtful land use planning is absolutely critical. So local governments need to step up.
Well, let me ask you one last question in the segment. That is, you know, there's the major arguments against California's climate change legislation effort has been it puts the state at a competitive disadvantage vis-a-vis other states or even nations. Business groups, for example, say it's going to cripple their industries. What is your response to that?
We're finding so many success stories here. It's hard to find a lot of cases where that is true. We have more people hired in this new clean, sustainable field in jobs that are well-paying jobs. This is the future. You can invest, perhaps, if you want, in coal-fired power plants in other states. Most people are not investing anymore in coal-fired power plants. They know that's a thing of the past. So they have moved to this new energy space. And what we have to do in California is be very thoughtful in the transition, work with our existing businesses to make them competitive in the marketplace. We're sensitive to that. But I'm also personally working in other states. Other states now are really investing in this policy.
Following California's lead, well, I want to thank State Senator Fran Pavley for joining us. Up next, what is the business community's response to the state's climate change legislation? Is it an obstacle or an opportunity? That conversation next. This is the Maddie Report.
Welcome back. So what does the business community think of California's climate change efforts? Rob Lapsley, the president of the California Business Roundtable, joins us to talk about the potential impact on the California economy. Welcome back to the Matty Report.
Thank you.
Supporters say that California's climate change legislation is essentially kind of, you can have it all, strong economy and a more sustainable environment. What do you think?
So our response to that is that it has yet to be proven. So the California business community has been supportive of trying to achieve the climate change goals. If the science is there, recognize we have a obviously huge role to play, and we want to see a goal established that's achievable, but that would be able to provide balance to California's economy. So the most important thing for everyone to recognize right now is that we are only a couple years into this. The bill might have been passed 10 years ago, AB 32, but we're just really still starting the implementation of that. And we do not have enough information yet to truly understand the intended and unintended consequences of this policy, much less try and understand where it goes in the future.
Yeah, you know, kind of ties into my next question. That is, you've said that this new Senate Bill 32 was not drafted with an eye toward the lessons learned with AB 32. So what were the lessons that were ignored?
Well, first and foremost is we yet do not have enough data on AB 32 on what the real impacts are, particularly to the average Californian. Case in point, that prices are going up for gasoline, prices are going up for electricity as a result of our climate change policies. That is hitting the average Californian right in the pocketbook, not to mention the cost that it's impacting on California businesses. We pay double the electricity price for manufacturing facilities in California than anywhere else in the country, at a minimum.
Well, what about the argument that buildings are going to become more efficient? So, yes, maybe the rates may go up, but you're using less electricity.
Prove it.
You want to see the data.
So, this has to be now, we've set the goal, it has to be a data-driven argument. We need to be able to understand exactly what we're achieving, what actual greenhouse gas reductions we're getting, at what cost, and then how is it truly impacting the average middle-class Californian so we can craft the best possible policy moving forward. We're leading the world. We got to show the world we can have the best policy. And they're making the next generation decisions before we actually have good data. That's our concern.
You know, one of the interesting things here is they're saying that, you know, 70 to 80% of the job is already done. But that does mean you still got 20 or 30% left to go. And is one of the arguments here that you've already addressed the low-hanging fruit, and so now it becomes a case of diminishing returns where it's become more expensive to get that next 20 or 30% reduction?
Mark, that's putting it exactly right. That's well said. And so every time you have a policy, when the first couple of years you can do some of the easier things that people aren't going to really see or feel. Sure, it's great to go out and get all this solar. Okay, but the next round of decision-making, I was just looking at it literally this morning of what CARB is talking about at their meeting today. And the next round shows that the main growth under this policy is going to be potentially in auto manufacturing. There's going to be huge declines in cement and all these other manufacturing areas that literally is going to drive business to other states. And it's in CARB's own discussions.
Yeah, it seems like there are going to be winners and losers as this plays out. The ARB, speaking of the ARB, there was a lot of discussion last time about, you know, what their role should be. There was an attempt in a companion piece to SB 32, that is AB 197, sorry for the numbers here, but it really focused on more legislative oversight of the ARB. Do you think that they struck the appropriate balance?
Well, it was an improvement for sure. So ARB obviously has a huge role to play, but they should not be making major economic decisions for all of California's future by themselves. That's what our argument was. And we would still like to see actually greater oversight on CARB by the fact that any major decision surrounding climate change, or frankly, any other major regulatory decision of, say, you know, like $100 to $200 million or more statewide, should actually go back to the legislature for final approval. Let's make sure that there's additional layers to get it right. And that's not, when you talk to the average Californian, an unreasonable concept.
Yeah, some polling data seems to support that. Yeah. Well, up next, we're going to talk about California's cap and trade program and what comes next in the battle for climate change or over climate change. That conversation in a moment. This is Mark Kepler with the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with Rob Lapsley with the California Business Roundtable about California's landmark climate change program. You know, SB 32 they recently passed was pretty far-reaching, but it was silent on a pretty big issue, and that was cap and trade. Is there a kind of a cause and effect with the legal limbo that cap and trade is currently in and the auctions now that are coming in well below expectations?
Yes, without a doubt. And, you know, what happened with cap and trade originally, you know, the business community supports a market-based mechanism, we think, as we're in the infancy still of this whole area of trying to address climate change in California. That this is the right approach to get started to see if we can get the real emission reductions. But most importantly, when they passed cap and trade originally, it's a tax. And they needed a two-thirds vote.
That's the question. Yeah, that is the question. But they always say, if you go back and look at this, oh, this is not a tax.
Yes, and now it's being litigated because of that very issue. And because it didn't pass from a two-thirds vote, a court case is working its way through that will actually have an opinion very quickly next, you know, 2 months or so at the appellate level that will make that final ruling. Yeah. And because of that, it's impacted the amount of credits that are trading. And as a result, it's gone, you know, way down to almost, you know, just, what, $20 million.
Yeah, quite a bit less.
Which is not, makes it an effective mechanism.
Yeah, $20 million, only in Sacramento, $20 million, not so much.
but now when it started at $500 million.
Right. You know, Governor Brown's thinking that, you know, he actually has the levers with this legislation to continue cap and trade, because he said, listen, if SB 32 targets are there and we don't have cap and trade, it's going to be this command and control. Command being, we'll tell you what targets to hit, and control will tell you how to hit those targets, which means business loses flexibility. So he's thinking, if that's the alternative, business is going to go for cap and trade. You agree?
So, yes, predominantly. But let me give you the other side of that argument. So, one, it has to be a cap and trade that's effective. It has to work. Number two, the alternative to a cap and trade is what's called a carbon tax. That's actually on a statewide ballot up in Washington State for the election in November. Then you can apply a carbon tax to essentially anything, you know, regarding business, individuals. It's all in how it's crafted by the legislature and how it would work. You could put it in at the wellhead. You could put it in at the pump.
It's that three-letter word tax, I think, that would probably – cap and trade doesn't sound, frankly, like a tax. And you call a carbon tax, it's in the definition.
Well, cap and trade, you know, ideally is – a market-based mechanism that allows for, you know, credits to be traded at a level that provides balance in this. You only have to buy what you need. And by doing that, you're reducing your emissions, which the business community, I can tell you unequivocally, is working hard to reduce their emissions to be able to meet the climate change goals.
You know, I want to ask you the same question I asked Senator Fran Pavley earlier in the show, and that is some recent surveys show that the partisan divide over climate change has gotten even greater since AB 32 was enacted, you know, a decade ago. Why do you think that is?
So, you know, it's interesting. I see data all over the board. I've seen some of that, that the Republicans are more skeptical, if you will, on some of the climate change data, where the Democrats are not. I've also seen data where it actually is kind of in the middle, where both of them recognize that there most likely is a problem and that it needs to be addressed. So it seems to be kind of a cyclical thing right now with what's happening in the news, depending upon when you take the poll, mm-hmm. depending upon informing the opinion. But Republicans, I tend to be more skeptical of huge regulatory efforts from government in general, and I think anything regarding this is also a reflection of that.
Well, let me ask you one last question. That is, where's the future of climate change policy? Where is this going? Is there a way that there can be a mutual advantage here for both business and environmentalists in terms of climate change actions?
Yes, and that comes with the intersection, ideally, of, you know, what they call a more green economy or green jobs. Now, from the Business Roundtable standpoint, we are tracking very closely the green jobs that are supposed to be happening under this policy. And right now, I can tell you unequivocally that as we track this very closely, the most that we have seen to date is at best 2% of all of California jobs. We have roughly 17 million jobs in California. 2% of those are most the green job. So it is not growing anywhere near what it should be growing to date. That's, again, one of our causes for concern. And they also pay much less than jobs that have paid in the oil and gas sector, that have paid in the manufacturing sector, sectors that we're losing jobs in because of our competitiveness.
We'll have to take a close look at that. Well, I want to thank Rob Lapsley with the California Business Roundtable for joining us, also California State Senator Fran Pavley. If you want to stay current on state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Institute on Twitter and Facebook, or you can log on to our website at maddieinstitute.org. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
Up next, what impact will the state climate change policy have on the Valley? We'll ask Nathan Alonzo, Government Affairs Manager with the Fresno Chamber of Commerce, Daniel Bergstrom, Director of Government Affairs for the City of Fresno, and former State Senate Majority Leader and current Cal Air Resources Board member Dean Flores.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
We have two very different perspectives on the state's approach to climate change and what it may mean for the Valley. We've got former State Senate Majority Leader and current California Air Resources Board member, Dean Flores. Welcome, Senator Flores.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Former Senator Flores is probably the official title, but thank you very much for being here. We also have Nathan Alonzo, who is the Government Affairs Manager for the Fresno Chamber of Commerce. Welcome, Nathan.
Happy to be here, Mark. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So, Nathan, let's start with you. We have a new president, soon to have a new president, President Trump. What do you think that he's going to mean for climate change generally and California's efforts in particular?
Anytime that we talk about a change of administration, regardless of party, we're talking about a different approach to a subject that has been taking center stage for quite a while now, and that's climate change and policy issues that any elected official takes towards that. It's going to be different, obviously, than what the Obama administration has. During the campaign, we didn't hear too much from either President-elect Trump or Secretary Clinton on what their specific plans were for climate change. So it'll be interesting to see how the administration takes a new approach to climate change in conjunction with having a new Congress, which is...
Yeah, the Republicans are going to have the executive branch. They're going to have both houses of Congress and arguably the Supreme Court. They're going to have all three branches of government.
So with all of the new changes after election night, it'll be interesting to see what will happen as far as any administration approach on climate issues. And it'll be interesting to see who some of these appointed positions, who comes into those, because that'll kind of set the tone of how it all goes forward.
Yeah. You know, so a former Senator Flores, I mean, you know, during the campaign, and campaigns are one thing and governing is another. But during the campaign, of course, President-elect Trump said that he thought that climate change was a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese to make us less competitive. It sounds, at least on the campaign trail, that he wasn't a big supporter of climate change efforts being done in California. You're on the California Air Resources Board. It doesn't sound like the U.S. EPA is going to be the partner it's been in the past. What are your thoughts on President-elect Trump and his effect on climate change generally and California's efforts in particular?
Yeah, well, it's clear they did not talk about it in depth at any of the debates. I mean, the word climate change was really kind of left out of the equation. But I can say, I mean, even though we've had a change in administration, I'm pretty sure that President Trump can't change the fact that the world is heating up and we're reaching this tipping point. And the fact that, you know, cleaner energy is still, you know, cheaper than dirty fuels today. I mean, we've passed that threshold about 10 years ago in terms of, you know, trying to meet renewables goals. So I think, you know, it's going to be a very different experience for the new president. I mean, in some sense, he's definitely not going to be the CEO of the United States. I mean, government doesn't work that way. Although I think, you know, he'll have to learn that there's a lot of negotiation that will then need to take place. But clearly the Clean Power Act will be, you know, something that's dead on arrival. I don't see the Trump administration moving forward on that. Whether or not he can turn away the regulations, which, as you know, are stakeholder driven, will be yet to be seen. But as you know, those regulations take years and years to unwind, even if you would like to unwind them. And clearly there are priorities in terms of funding. But the regulation portion of climate change is still, you know, many, many years to be unwound. So you know, I took some hope that in his meeting with President Obama today, that he was going to, you know, offer a different view of how we might govern, because we really don't know that yet. But, his, you know, interesting, his website that's out now looking for appointments to the EPA and others, you know, he said, and I'll quote it, he says, full use of our domestic energy sources, including traditional and renewable energy sources, kind of tells me that he recognizes that we're well down the path on renewable sources to reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. And he recognizes it. So I think it's you know, I think we ought to give him an opportunity to govern and sort all of this out. But I was very happy to see that he has thrown in some of the key words. Whether or not it'll be all, you know, Obama administration, clearly not.
You know, it's interesting, you know, Valley legislative elected officials have had this kind of attitude. I think Ken Matty, frankly, with the Institute was named after, always thought that whether you're Republican or Democrat, if you came from the Valley as a legislator, you had this ability to compromise and work across the aisle. And I sound like I'm hearing a little bit of that from you, frankly. Let me ask you this, though. You know, so we've got someone now on the Air Resources Board from the San Joaquin Valley. You know, that's an incredibly important position. What kind of unique perspective do you think you bring to the board that may have been missing in the past?
Well, I can definitely tell you that as a legislator, trying to better our relationship with the legislature is going to be one. You know, the Air Board has had a tradition and in some sense a reputation that it's been this elite institution devoid of any sort of discussion with the legislature. And that's shown in legislation passed this year. You saw AB 197 being passed, which was more of a command and control type of missive from the legislature to get the Air Board focused
and just,
on the
just
right
to clarify, just a minute, so for our folks, they may, when you say command and control, I mean, you and I would use that term, and people who read a lot of this stuff probably understand it, but that means basically traditional regulation, where the government sets a regulation and tells a business or an individual, you have to do this, which is very different than cap and trade, where you say, well, you know, you can buy these credits, and if you want to pollute, you can pollute, just pay the credits. And if you can find a cheaper way not to pollute, then, you know, do it the most cost-effective way you can figure out. So it gives business a little bit more latitude.
Yeah, exactly. I think you've nailed it exactly. And so I think overall, being a legislator on the Air Board, it's clearly a transition from being a legislator to a regulator. The regulation side of the world now for me is really about what we focus on the Air Board. And coming from the Valley, you know, not to say that greenhouse and climate change and carbon aren't, you know, the most important thing, but they're equal. I mean, the reality is pollution, straight old pollution that the Valley faces has got to be back on the agenda as a co-equal to some of the climate change greenhouse issues that we are currently facing. So cap and trade really is going to be quite interesting, and particularly as you look at the Trump administration and who they put in the EPA, I expect to see that administration focus more on the pollution side of things. You know, whether they can use renewables to also reduce those pollution is going to be really critical for the Valley, not go back to kind of coal and oil types of bases. But it seems to me that, you know, we might see more of a focus on pollution than we will some of the climate change issues that Trump seemed to be saying weren't as important.
And any thoughts, just the way you said that, I was thinking, what about the implications for like the South Valley, Kern County, and the oil industry down there? Do you think that they're going to be producing more, or is it now, you know, renewables are getting to the point where they're really competitive with traditional sources of energy?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when Trump was talking, at least during his campaign, about, you know, moving back to kind of oil-based, coal-based. I mean, I think he was really talking to those critical states, you know, back way far away from us, at least 2,000 or 3,000 miles. But for Kern County, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, today you see Kern County, and it's really the wind capital of the world. I mean, it's one of the largest renewable fields ever. And, you know, what's different, I think, is the fact that, you know, the costs for wind are down 40%. The costs for solar are down 60%. LED lighting and efficiency is down 90%. You know, it's a different era now. We've gone so far down the renewable path that is now competitive with the oil industry, even in Kern County and some of the lower half of the valley. So I really don't see us kind of going back to those traditional sources. I see a transformation of jobs to the more, you know, green types of jobs, just the way of the world. I mean, people are, you know, I think now this is the cheapest and most market-based way to provide energy.
Now, I want to ask,
the industry is something different.
Yeah, I want to ask Nathan about that with the Chamber of Commerce. I mean, how do you see like AB 32 and climate change legislation in California? Is there, as former Senator Flores is mentioning, a possible economic benefit to all of this?
Well, in looking at the passage of SB 32 in this last legislative session, from a business community standpoint, we were extremely concerned with the passage of SB 32, given that we still don't know what the economic impacts are of AB 32. And there
the
was
original law.
The original law back in 2006. And there was no economic impact study done on SB 32 to kind of give us an indication of what we would be looking at post-passage here in the Valley.
You know, it was interesting. We interviewed Ron Lapsley in the earlier segment. What he was saying was he wasn't sure that the legislature learned the lessons of AB 32 when they were enacting SB 32. That was one of his points.
So now we have, you know, layering upon layering of different climate legislation with AB 32, now SB 32, and then the kind of the motor that drives SB 32, AB 197. And we don't know what the impacts are going to be, but we do know that with the inaction of SB 32, two of the Valley's largest economic industries are going to be severely affected, and that's the ag industry and the energy industry. The passage of SB 32 means a few things. It means more stringent requirements as far as emissions goes for the ag industry, which is an industry that we know produces, you know, ag's dusty. Ag is... It's farming, and it's something that it's hard to bring the emissions down, and strenuous efforts are made by the private sector to ensure that they're being a lot more efficient in the way that they do things. And then the energy sector, which has been, you know, heavily regulated in the state. So it's concerning on the jobs front because we live in an area of the state that is, you know, it's hurting for jobs. And we're
traditional
afraid,
high unemployment.
Yeah, double-digit unemployment in most Valley counties, and we're afraid of what this is going to mean as far as job loss in our region.
Well, let me ask this. You know, former Senator Flores was mentioning, you know, this whole idea of command and control versus cap and trade. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, one of the things we were talking with Rob Lapsley, he was saying that certainly if you had to choose between the two, they prefer cap and trade. I just want to get your impressions of that. I mean, command and control versus cap and trade as a way to deal with this issue.
Well, Rob would be right in that regard because command and control – gets a lot scarier because you are kind of boxed into these stringent requirements as far as what you have to do, and there's no flexibility within the law. With cap and trade, as you talked about earlier, there is credits that you can buy that allow you to continue functioning the way that you are, or you have the option of, you know, retool and reform the way that you do things in order to comply with the current standards.
Let's the business be entrepreneurial about
the
situation.
Exactly. And flexibility, especially in a state that's so heavily regulated like California, is the flexibility is critical in allowing our businesses the ability to, you know, comply with the law while still being as profitable as they can, while still being as competitive as they can, because as we know, neighboring states have regulatory and economic climates that are a lot more conducive.
Right. So, not just states, but also nations. I mean, California is basically, if you think about the size of California, it's really a nation. Let me ask you this, you know, former Senator Flores. I'm curious about your impressions about a PPIC, Public Policy Institute of California, poll about the partisan divide over climate change. And what they found, not surprisingly, maybe the election reflected this, is that the divide has gotten wider since the passage of AB 32 a decade ago. Do you see that trend continuing? What are your thoughts on that?
No, I actually see it as a reflection of just where the politics generally have gone. I mean, if you look at that poll and if you look at past other polls, you know, the country itself on every issue pretty much is just moving to polar opposites. There's very little middle ground. Very few people are moving to the middle. And in fact, they're very entrenched in what I would call, you know, their particular tribe, if you will, or camp, where when climate change comes up, I mean, people get really dig in. However, I do think the science of climate change is well proven. And I think folks who are now, you know, looking towards the science are going to find that we are making a dramatic shift. The economy is changing to more renewable sources. And I think that you're going to have to rely on just whatever, you know, I think the science is going to, wherever it's going to take us at some point in time. I think that's how we get folks moving back towards each other. And quite frankly, you know, I think with a new Trump administration and a different focus beyond climate change, I think you're going to find some issues like pollution, things that we face in the valley, like dairies, methane, and some of the issues that, you know, plague our air quality are going to be very high on the agenda, hopefully, for a new administration wanting to focus on something that the EPA can show some results on more immediately. So I'm hopeful that a Trump administration, if they're not high on climate change, will at least at the minimum head down the path to how do we, you know, make our air better to breathe, particularly in the Central Valley.
You know that's
so I think we ought to give them a chance. I really think we just, you know, we really don't know what to expect from a Trump administration other than, you know, if we don't give President Trump an opportunity to perform, you know, I mean, I think that we're both parties are going to lose, you know, and I have a feeling that we ought to be, you know, kind of looking and waiting to see, you know, what that top agenda will be.
You know, it's interesting. Maybe the common ground, I want to get Nathan to make a comment on this before we leave here, and that is, you know, you're talking about pollution. Pollution also causes health issues, which means workers are not on the job, higher costs for companies. And maybe, what do you think, Nathan? Are we going to see this divide start to shrink? Is it going to stay as wide or going to get wider? What are your thoughts?
In looking at political divide in America right now, it's something that's been an issue over the course of the last couple of political cycles in midterm elections, presidential elections. It's going to be interesting, like Senator Flores said, going forward to see what are some of the policy initiatives and what are some of the plans that the incoming administration is going to have. What are some realistic solutions that we can have as far as this issue of climate change and pollution goes? But it's also going to be incumbent upon the administration, Congress, and at the state legislative level to bring solutions forward that also help us create jobs and have a healthy business climate and job climate here within our state and our nation, because that's what's going to help us be more competitive as Californians with our neighboring states then as Americans on an international scale.
So I guess the answer is stay tuned. I want to thank our guests, Nathan Alonzo, Government Affairs Director with the Fresno Chamber of Commerce and former State Senate Majority Leader and current Cal Air Resources Board member, Dean Flores. Thanks both of you for joining us. Up next, we're going to talk about some of the specific examples about projects that are funded with cap and trade dollars that we may be seeing in the city of Fresno. That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We're now joined by Daniel Bergstrom, the Director of Government Affairs for the City of Fresno, to talk about some of the recent projects being funded by the state's cap and trade program. Welcome, Danielle.
Thanks. Thanks, Mark, for having me.
So listen, I assume cap and trade funds aren't automatic. What did the City of Fresno do to get access to those cap and trade proceeds?
Yeah, you're right. Most of the funds are not automatic, and we have done a lot of work in the city over the last few years to really figure out how to make ourselves competitive for the funds coming down the pike. So in the past year alone, we've actually received just over $100 million of proposed cap and trade funds to our city. The bulk of that, of course, being $70 million coming out of a new program called Transformational Climate Communities, which I can talk about a little bit more later, but that's really focused on integrated investments in transit, housing, energy efficiency, urban greening that really leverage private sector investment.
So
beyond
so,
that, we've seen. Oh, sorry. Go
no,
ahead.
No. Go ahead. Go ahead.
We've also seen just this year alone over $25 million going towards affordable and mixed income housing near transit. Two projects were funded, one in downtown Fresno next to the Ball Stadium, and another project was funded in southeast Fresno along Kings Canyon near Sunnyside High School. And we've also seen another $8 million come to Fresno this year for improving the way that we collect fares along our high-frequency transit corridors, bus rapid transit being one. And then we've also received some energy efficiency funds to do solar retrofits of houses around the city. So a lot of funding has been coming down.
Oh, okay, so $100 million, that is a lot of money. Out of a total pot of what? Do you have an idea how big the pot is that they're pulling from?
Yeah, it's just over $1 billion.
Right, so 10% for the city of Fresno, that is a significant amount. So you're talking about things like mixed income housing near high-speed rail construction. And by the way, whether or not high-speed rail happens, given the new Trump presidency, there remains to be seen, I guess. But there's still that the tracks are going to be used, could be used by passenger rail, other kinds of passenger rail. So it's not like those rail lines aren't going to be used. But you've got revitalizing the inner city, constructing bus rapid transit system. So a lot of different uses of these funds. So again, let's talk a little bit about those current projects that are underway. You're talking something about I read about a $20 million effort to return vehicular traffic to the Fulton Mall. How did that get cap and trade money?
So the Fulton Mall project itself did not receive cap and trade funds. But what has happened because of that investment, which the majority of that $20 million came from the federal government through another program, there have been a lot of private investment that we've seen, over $100 million so far in private investment once we made the decision to open up the Fulton Mall. And now, because of that location being so close to high-speed rail, but more importantly, located in the middle of the Valley's largest job center, over 40,000 people work around the Fulton Corridor every day. That's really an important place when it comes to climate funding, because a lot of the funds around climate are about connecting people to transit, letting people live closer to their jobs so they don't have a long commute, so they don't have to get on their car and hop on the 41 and go 30 minutes down the freeway to get to their job. But they may have an opportunity to live in a 3 or 4 story apartment building next to their job in downtown Fresno. So what we're seeing and what we've been planning for is really focusing a lot of the climate investments coming down on building out a downtown that supports higher density housing where people can live near their jobs. And that's something that we've seen, at least within our community in Fresno, a lot of our residents are really supportive of that. They don't necessarily want to A lot of folks that live in North Fresno don't necessarily want to see high-density buildings show up in their neighborhood, but they are supportive of seeing that type of housing happen in downtown where there's a lot of room and space to grow.
It seems like what they're attempting to do is provide other options. In other words, if you want the suburban lifestyle, you can have that, but if you want a more urban lifestyle, you can also have that. So it's providing people with options. Along those same lines, no pun intended, is the Bus Rapid Transit Project and their own line. Can you talk a little bit about the Bus Rapid Transit Project in Fresno?
Right. Yeah. So that is currently under construction, which you would observe if you drive near Blackstone or Ventura or Kings Canyon at all. We're very excited about that. That should be opening sometime early, middle to late of next year for operations. Once that project is done, you'll be able to go hop on the BRT system from downtown Fresno, get up to River Park in about 25 minutes.
So how does that compare to the current – if you're doing a bus now, what does it be, like 45 minutes or something?
Yeah, 45 to 50 minutes. So it's cutting that travel time about in half.
And the thing that makes it faster is what? It's a designated lane, and the lights are synchronized, so that gives kind of the bus the right-of-way to keep –
Yeah, that's a big – those are big components of it. But the other side of the equation is also speeding up the boarding process. So the buses will be low enough. They'll be about at grade with the platforms that you use to get onto the bus. So you're not stepping up steps. If you're in a wheelchair, you're not having to get a special ramp out. It's going to be a lot easier for folks who have handicap access to get onto the bus. And then also you're paying for your ticket outside of the bus. So there's not a long line of folks waiting to put their coins into the box once they get onto the bus. But you're already paid and you could just walk on.
So quick on, quick off. And if you make bus travel competitive with auto travel, you're thinking that people might want to, hop on the bus and go up to River Park from downtown or vice versa on the BRT.
Right, absolutely.
I want to ask you, though, one of the issues is, got this money coming in. There was, $70 million was allocated out of the $140 million appropriated from this California Strategic Growth Council's Transformational Climate Communities Program, a lot of money, half the money coming to the city of Fresno. And some folks are wondering, the Ashley Swearengin administration is coming to an end. Lee Brand's our new mayor. Has that money all been allocated and already been kind of programmed? Or is there going to be a way to program some of that money in the future, and how would you go about doing that?
Yeah, so the money has definitely not been appropriated or allocated. So let me just start off by saying CARB has the Air Resources Board has a very strict process for identifying which types of projects can and cannot be funded by cap and trade auction proceeds. So we have been watching and following the way in which they select projects from their other programs that they fund to help us start to develop a filter for how we might spend the $70 million coming to Fresno. So that's one side of the equation. The other is that the Strategic Growth Council has really signaled that they are very interested in developing a guidelines process, a public guidelines process, so that there's a clear and transparent way in which the projects that ultimately get funded are selected. And so those guidelines will likely be dependent on a lot of factors that are related to both enhancing climate policy, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, increasing transit usage, and those types of things, as well as leveraging private sector investment. And there's a very strong programmatic focus in this program in particular on leveraging the private sector. And so for us, we think that probably signals that we'll see funding going more towards investments such as housing, energy efficiency, and to some extent transportation, as those are the types of things that are a lot easier to bring in private dollars to help make your project whole versus other types of projects.
So you're going to see a lot of public involvement and private sector involvement in this whole process as it rolls out. Well, I want to thank Daniel Bergstrom, the Director of Government Affairs for the City of Fresno, Nathan Alonzo, Director of Government Affairs for the Fresno Chamber of Commerce, and former State Senate Majority Leader and current Cal Air Resources Board member Dean Flores, all for joining us. Thanks so much. The views and opinions expressed on the Matter Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Matty Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Matty Report, visit our website at mattyinstitute.org.
The Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.